From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. This week, the next in the series of what is entitled Breaking the Glass Ceiling of Virtual Conversations that are sponsored by the Northwest Indiana Influential Women Association will focus on one person as a guest speaker who has done a lot in her career. She's gone basically from a local store manager position to the role of president and CEO of Goodwill Industries of Michiana Incorporated. Debbie Coble is with us. And Debbie, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's quite an honor to be able to get called in and have to sit up there and speak to so many people. Of course, we never know how many are going to watch, but it is free, so a lot of people could listen very intently to what you have to say. So I'm sure that they're very interested in your life and certainly your career and how you've been able to bring yourself to the point of being in charge of quite an operation. For people that are not necessarily familiar with how big the Goodwill Industries of Michiana is, will you tell us about it first?
Sure. So Goodwill, we have territories, if you would. There's 156 Goodwills in North America, and our particular territory serves 16 counties in Indiana, from Elkhart, Kosciuszko, all the way over to the Illinois state line, and then we go into actually Will Cook and Kankakee counties in Illinois, and then we have the city of Niles, Michigan. So 16 counties, part of three and part of one.
I think it turns out that people really only have much contact with Goodwill Industries by the stores that are out there all over the region. But there is a main reason why the stores are there, and that's to help people that maybe need a little help along the way in being able to be more self-sufficient, if anything else, right?
Absolutely. We focus on three different pillars: education, job training, and job placement. And as you said, our stores exist to help us fund that mission so that we're able to help the communities we have the privilege of serving.
One of the things I know that these opportunities to be involved in the Breaking the Glass Ceiling series of conversations bring people together to learn more about a particular person. And your particular case is very interesting, that certainly more people want to find out about when the presentation happens on Wednesday the 28th. Is how that you managed to start out as a store manager and move up the ranks to become the boss, literally the boss of the operation. Will you go through the process? Tell us about yourself, your experiences that you had before, maybe even before you got into Goodwill Industries work, but you've been able to follow through ever since.
Sure. So right out of college, I actually started at Venture, if you remember the Venture stores.
Mm-hmm.
I helped open the first one in Mishawaka, Indiana. And I left there the management style there just did not fit my management style. And so I then went on to try my hand at financial planning, had my Series 6, had my life insurance license. And at that point in time, you sold financial plans, and I wasn't so good at that. So before they realized how bad I was at it, I started looking for another position, and a couple folks at church worked for Goodwill, and they really enjoyed it, and there was a retail position open, so I applied for it with the intent of only staying around a year. And then about 9 months into it, got a call from Human Resources and had the opportunity to move into the mission part of the organization. And that's where I just absolutely fell in love with Goodwill. And my one-year stint now, 31 years later, I can't imagine myself being any other place because I just continuously had the opportunity to grow. And they supported my education. They supported my development. And for 7.5 years now, I've been sitting in this role as president.
It's great to hear. What was the most interesting thing about going in this job in particular, going from just working like at what normally would be a resale store to get yourself involved in the mission of Goodwill Industries? It's much, as we've mentioned earlier in the conversation, it's much more than just selling clothing or other items at the stores. It's helping people get themselves up, give them a bootstrap to pull themselves up by.
That's it, exactly, and that's where my heart and soul is, whether it's an employee, whether it's a person from the community that we have the privilege of serving. There's just so many stories that are near and dear to my heart where we have got to walk the journey with somebody. We just recently did a highlight of a young lady. She's been with us for 5 years, came through programming, 5 years sober now. She has met an individual she plans to spend the rest of her life with. He actually works here as well. They've gone through some of our training program, financial management, They are debt-free. They have purchased a car and now have purchased a home. And we just get to be a part of that. And that just is, that's transformational, and it just makes it so exciting to come to work every day.
When you got started and you had a chance to move up the ranks, so to speak, as you say, going from being just a local store manager, going into administration, were there things that you learned along the way, experiences that you had along the way that you'll be able to go into more detail at when you get to talk virtually with everybody at the Breaking the Glass Ceiling series tomorrow?
Absolutely, because obviously the maturity of a store manager and the maturity of professional maturity are very different. So I definitely had to grow along the way, and I had definite opportunities that helped me do that.
Can you tell us about some of these opportunities that maybe were kind of more like chaos at first, but you were able to learn from?
You know, I think one, and I'm not sure if this is quite what you're looking for, but mm-hmm. I had an employee one time who was going to leave us, and she was very upset with me because I did not teach her office politics. And I thought, well, what are you talking about? And I was a little taken back by it. But then as I got to thinking about it, and I think something that has helped me grow is that, yes, that is my job. I mean, I'd love to tell you we don't have office politics, but in reality, if there's an office, there are politics, right? And so I've been more mindful of that, of to try to help people understand why things function the way they do. I have two fairly new employees right now that we have what we call history lessons a lot.
Right.
And so to help them understand why we've made decisions and where we're at as we're looking to the future and how do we need to change those things. And so that was a moment that is kind of humorous, but I will tell you, it really had an impact on me and how I look at helping my folks adjust in the workplace.
Are these some of the real-world barriers that you'll get to talk more about, of course, in your talk, but you've had to talk with your employees, and we're talking not only employees that are in the main office, but the stores, to have to deal with?
Oh, absolutely, because one of the things that we need to remember is the folks that we have the privilege of serving, they have had many different types of barriers in their life, and it shaped their experience. And so one of the things that we have to do is we have to learn to walk with folks from all different lifestyles and all different experiences to be able to help mentor them into a world that they can excel at and they can see their dreams come true. And that's an art, and it's a skill that has to be developed. And so we've been working with our store managers to give them more tools to be able to do that.
Are there opportunities that you'll get a chance to talk about and maybe questions you'll get to answer during the Q&A session that'll come up, I guess, after your speech, where maybe even men should be taking advantage of this? I know it's focusing primarily on women because the organization is set up the Breaking the Glass Ceiling as the theme for the web series, but I'm sure there's something that men probably should learn from this.
Oh, absolutely. I think anybody can join and listen to this if they so choose. I think it really is just a story of taking advantage of opportunities presented, but not, you know, I mean, it makes it sound like I got everything that I wanted, you know, and I had my setbacks. I had things that I wanted to do at work that I was told no and those kinds of things. But it also really is, I think some of it's my style of management that we'll talk about and how I manage the folks. So I hope that folks can take something away from it that's beneficial to them in their careers.
Well, Debbie, thank you for spending time with us talking about yourself, about your career, moving up the ranks from store manager to CEO, which, by the way, is the title for the Wednesday, April 28th web session, which is entitled in the series, Breaking the Glass Ceiling. And thank you very much for spending time with us, and the best of luck with you, of course, not only in what you're going to be talking with people about this week, but also in the months ahead, too, working with Goodwill Industries of Michiana Incorporated.
Thank you so much.
Unprecedented, very, very unique. Nothing was normal. Nothing was easy. That's how lawmakers have described this year's legislative session. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on how COVID-19 changed the work and the results of the 2021 General Assembly.
The changes started last year. A small committee of lawmakers met to try to figure out how to conduct the 2021 legislative session amid the ongoing pandemic. And even that first meeting revealed potential roadblocks. One of the members had to participate virtually because he was in quarantine. And when he got disconnected, Representative Matt Lehman had to halt the meeting.
We'll take a 5-minute recess and until we get, or if he comes up in the next minute, we'll start back up again.
Ultimately, the House moved out of the State House entirely into a government center across the street for its floor sessions, allowing for greater social distancing. In committees, lawmakers and the public were separated, often in different rooms, connected virtually. House Democratic Leader Phil Giaquinta laments the impact that had on public participation.
Probably the worst part this session was, I think most of the public really didn't want to come down here and testify, and then they would have to log on via Zoom. I think that really cut down public input.
Yet, despite just about everyone predicting otherwise, the General Assembly never had to halt its work this year because of a COVID-19 outbreak. But a COVID outbreak isn't the only way a session gets off track. About halfway through, a House floor debate over a local schools bill took a troubling turn. Black lawmakers, including Representative Vernon Smith, expressed concerns about the potential impact of the legislation.
And I don't care how you twist it, how you paint it, how you disguise it, how you camouflage it, it's racism. You boo if you want to. I don't care.
Smith and other members of the Black Legislative Caucus were booed and heckled on the floor by some Republicans. That turned into a confrontation outside the chamber, during which a white male lawmaker had to be physically restrained in an argument with a black female legislator. Representative Cherish Pryor, a Black Caucus member, says it was a defining moment.
With some of the people that were involved, it has not bode well with me. I think it's been very difficult.
The wounds of that incident still linger, and Black Caucus Chair Robin Shackelford has urged change to help address it, calling for implicit bias training for all lawmakers.
They personally feel like we're calling them racist. They don't understand the difference between arguing a policy and taking it personally.
House Speaker Todd Houston apologized for his role in failing to silence his caucus's jeering. And he says COVID-19 even made that situation worse.
It bothered me how hard it was for members to get together and get to know each other better and spend time together. I thought that was unfortunate.
Houston still hasn't publicly committed to implicit bias training in the future. Perhaps the biggest legislative surprise of session, though, came at its very end. Lawmakers found themselves with billions of dollars more for the new state budget, spurred in part by federal COVID relief money. That led to several longtime Democratic priorities getting put in the budget, including measures to raise teacher pay. Not a single House Democrat voted against the state's new spending plan. And even the session's finale was altered by COVID-19.
We're going to have a different type of motion this year. It's going to be missing a couple of words.
Those missing words? Sine die, a Latin phrase signifying the official end of session. The pandemic caused delays in getting necessary information from the federal government for redistricting. And that means instead of the session's end, it became a pause until the fall when lawmakers will reconvene to redraw district lines. Just one more way, COVID-19 made 2021 unlike anything the Indiana General Assembly had seen before. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Governor Eric Holcomb has vetoed a law that would require gasoline with 15% ethanol to be labeled at the pump. E15 gas can harm the engine of cars that are built before 2001, as well as some motorcycles, boats, and lawnmowers. Holcomb says the Environmental Protection Agency already requires E15 to be labeled, and he called it an unnecessary and confusing additional layer of government. But the EPA may not require those labels for long. Under the Trump administration in January, the EPA had proposed modifying or removing the label off E15 gas to provide additional opportunity for E15 within the fuel's marketplace, as the order comes. The EPA suggests that because many people are driving cars newer than 2001, it's time to reevaluate whether the E15 label is needed. Ethanol manufacturers say that the law is the oil industry's attempt to reduce competition from biofuels at the pump. Ethanol has been touted as a more climate-friendly alternative to traditional gasoline, but ethanol mandates haven't had a big impact on greenhouse gas emissions, and environmental activists say the need to grow more corn has led to the destruction of wildlife habitat. Indiana high school students taking career and technical courses like welding and cosmetology are wrapping up a statewide competition this week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports because of the pandemic, it looks a little different this year as the students are competing virtually.
As schools went virtual this past year, many had to adapt their hands-on CTE courses. The statewide Skills USA competition, often a culminating experience for those students, is trying something new as well. After being canceled last year, this year students are competing through video, photos, or online submissions. Kelly Baker is the statewide director for Skills USA Indiana. She says having students share their mostly hands-on work in a virtual format has proved challenging, but it's an important moment for CTE students.
It's a little bit different, but we're ready to be in full swing in person next year, keeping our fingers crossed.
Based on their performance in Indiana, students could compete in a national competition, also virtual this year, or win scholarships from colleges. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
My husband and I, we've adopted two girls who were born in China. Early on, when we adopted our first daughter and she came home as an 11-month-old, we felt really embraced and pleasantly surprised when going out to a restaurant or going out waiting in line at the store, the response that we would have most of the time from people in the community who, you know, would smile and say, oh, isn't she cute, and ask us questions, sometimes too many questions, but who were curious in a very positive way. And that was wonderful. I mean, I felt reaffirmed as an adoptive parent, and I felt hopeful, you know, for the future of my daughter and how she would eventually live, you know, her young life out in this community. And I won't say that that's been replaced by anything negative, but when babies stop being babies, you don't get the attention or the recognition that there's something special about your family or something different in a positive way about your family. And, you know, perhaps that's fine because I don't really need my 8-year-old hearing questions or too many comments from complete strangers when she can understand. But I do wonder about how things are going to progress for her in elementary school. That, and I wonder how I'm going to be able to help her navigate that, because I haven't had that experience of being the person of a different ethnicity in a community, except for the short few weeks that I've been to China. I don't really have an answer. I guess we'll just take it as it comes. I'm a big advocate for the Hilltop House down on Old Campus. It was the only preschool that we would have considered just because it's got such a diverse group of kids there. The teachers are diverse, ethnically diverse. There's a, you know, span of socioeconomic backgrounds for these kids. I love that my older daughter makes reference to her friend Regina as brown. And when I was a kid, we didn't talk about brown. It was black and white. And it's small. It's really subtle. Wasn't anything that we taught her. You know, that just kind of also speaks to the real diversity in skin tone and facial features and hair, that you just can't lump all Chinese people in one group. We'll all put out our arms in the middle of the table and she'll look at her younger sister's skin color and mine and my husband's. And, you know, we see that there's a range, lighter than, darker than. I guess that's the extent she has described her own skin color. My mother-in-law, she will describe my older daughter's hair as black. Say, well, no, it's not black. It's dark brown. It's kind of like mine. It's actually really close to my color. And she's, oh, I guess you're right. I guess I just, you know, just keep, you know, bouncing back to that thought about Chinese people having dark black straight hair. It's not so simple as that.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Back tomorrow.